Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Rachel Jones from the Guttmacher Institute about new research into the demographics of women getting abortions. Also, a preliminary segment on Barack Obama's new nominee to the Supreme Court, and a roundup of coverage of the pill's 50th anniversary. Anti-gay, anti-choice fundee Christian group Family Research Council got into the news recently when one of their founders, George Reekers, was caught touting a male prostitute he hired from rentboy.com all over Europe for a 10-day vacation. And this was after firing off a letter to every school district in the country about how gay kids could be cured of homosexuality. Naturally, Stephen Colbert had the funniest coverage.
Now, an ordinary anti-gay crusading pooch would stick its tail between its legs, but this alpha dog mounted a stiff defense. On his Facebook page, Reekers justified his trip by barking, "Like Jesus Christ, I deliberately spend time with sinners with the loving goal of trying to help them." Yes, Jesus spent time with prostitutes. That's why good Christians should always ask themselves, WBWJR, what boy would Jesus rent?
Stories like this just help convince me that these conservative religious leaders are basically charlatans who picked up culture war activism because it was lucrative, and they see their base as nothing but easy marks. Since the frantic opposition to Barack Obama was raising hay about a Supreme Court nomination before a nominee was even named, we all had to know that it was going to be a three-ring circus when the president finally coughed up a nominee. Well, now he has. Elena Kagan, a former Harvard Law School dean and the current Solicitor General. If confirmed, she'll be the fourth woman to sit on the bench, and this will be the first time that three women serve at the same time.
I am honored and I am humbled by this nomination and by the confidence you have shown in me. During the last year, as I have served as Solicitor General, my long-standing appreciation for the Supreme Court's role in our constitutional democracy has become ever deeper and richer. The Court is an extraordinary institution in the work it does and in the work it can do for the American people.
Expect the confirmation process to be even more swamped with grandstanding than usual, and not just because this is an election year. The opposition to Kagan is coming from both sides of the aisle. The left has a principled objection based on her views on civil liberties and government power. The right is invested in using the opportunity of a Supreme Court nomination to troll on abortion rights, gay rights, and their baseless accusations of socialism. And indeed, the first shot across the bow at her was basically a bunch of hooey about healthcare reform. Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming has stated his intention to use this confirmation process to float what amounts to a conspiracy theory about the constitutionality of healthcare reform.
The other issue is this whole healthcare bill that has just come out. There's a mandate that everybody in the country has to buy a product. That's a 10th Amendment issue. 20 states right now, Martha, are suing the federal government. Mm-hmm. And she is going to have to make a decision if she is on the court about how that goes forward with these 20 states suing. So where are state rights comes in? Where's the role of the federal government? What can they mandate from the American people?
Any realistic examination of these supposed state challenges would reveal that it's mostly right-wing pandering. These arguments hold as much water as long-standing right-wing conspiracy theories about how there's no real right for the federal government to tax its citizens, or maybe even that there's mind control elements in the drinking water. Anyone who actually tries to make an issue over this is putting childish political point scoring ahead of all other concerns. MSNBC had a general rundown of Kagan's career, and her resume's pluses and minuses.
down. She was the first woman solicitor general, and maybe even more of an all-male bastion that she broke down. She was the first woman to be dean of the Harvard Law School. And it's her service there that maybe the White House was impressed with. She had a reputation for building diversity in that faculty, bringing in more conservatives, bridging the gap between the two wings of political thought at Harvard. And she will have supporters among the conservatives there, including Charles Freed, who was President Reagan's solicitor general. He's a big supporter of hers. As the solicitor general, she's argued six cases here before the Supreme Court. So she comes with a long record in government and in academia. She worked in the Clinton White House. She met a young Barack Obama when she taught law at the University of Chicago when he was a part-timer on the faculty there. She knows Vice President Biden. She was detailed to his staff when he was chairman of the Judiciary Committee when the committee considered the nomination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So she has a lot of experience in the court, but one thing she doesn't have is any experience as a judge.
That she has a very thin record to point to of actual opinions is sadly just what the president probably wanted. It's become common wisdom that you want to nominate someone with very little in the way of political stances you can hang on them, especially when we're talking about things like abortion rights. A judge who hasn't weighed in on an abortion case is ideal, but someone like Kagan, who hasn't written judicial opinions, is a close runner-up. The idea is that this makes her harder to attack. Of course, the rules are only in play when the president is pro-choice, like Obama. Anti-choice presidents get to nominate whoever they like, and they often get to prove their bona fides by putting forward judges who've written disturbingly misogynist decisions, as Justice Alito has in the past when he argued that women should get their husbands' permissions for abortions. Of course, this lack of specific decisions to point to isn't going to stop the diehard conservatives who will attack any and everything that Obama does, no matter how much he tries to pander to the right. And right out of the box, the attacks are gender-based.
You don't really need to go too deep in analyzing the babe. I guess she could change her mind. She's a woman.
On that last bit, there's a bunch of right-wing hinting and rumor-mongering about Kagan's sexual orientation.
A CBSNews.com blog named the administration's current Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, as the most likely nominee, in part because she would please administration supporters as the first openly gay justice. CBS initially defended the post, but eventually took it down. But Washington Post media columnist Howard Kurtz wrote the Obama administration fired back at CBS, saying Kagan is not a lesbian. The author of the post is a blogger with a conservative track record and is a former Bush administration aide.
That blogger was Ben Dominic, and whatever he said after the fact in his faux apologies should be considered irrelevant. He was floating a rumor to rile up the homophobic, misogynist base, and I have no doubt it'll work. Already a bunch of fundy Christian organizations are firing off mass emails to rouse their base to oppose Kagan, not because of her views or experience, but because they believe she's a lesbian. Personally, I think it's really sad if Kagan were gay and felt like she couldn't be out. But what we do know is that she's shown some support for gay rights in the past when she pushed to keep military recruiters off Harvard's campus due to the military's official anti-gay stance. One thing I know for sure is this is going to be a bumpy ride. I'd like to welcome Rachel Jones to the program. Rachel is a senior research assistant at the Guttmacher Institute. The Institute recently released a report tracking the demographics of who gets abortions, and the big news was that there was a huge leap in the percentage of women who were under the poverty line. Rachel is here to talk about these findings. Welcome to RealityCast, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
The leap you found was startling. It was a 60% leap in the percentage of women who've had abortions that are under the federal poverty line, going from 27% of women who've had abortions in 2000 to 42% in 2008. What accounts for such a huge change?
Right. So admittedly, this particular survey is intended to describe, and so that was one of the important findings to come out of this, is describing the increase in the proportion of abortion patients who were poor. We didn't ask questions that could actually explain specifically why this increase occurred, but we do have some pretty good ideas. So first off is the fact that this survey occurred in the midst of an economic recession in 2008 and a little bit into 2009 is when we were gathering data. And so if you look at the larger population of women between 2000 and 2008 in the U.S., there was a 25% increase in the proportion of women who were poor in the larger population. So all other things being equal, you would expect an increase in poverty among abortion patients. Now, of course, the increase in poverty among abortion patients was substantially larger than what we saw among all women in the U.S., and again, we've identified a couple of reasons for that. First off is the fact that, you know, in the midst of a recession, an issue like pregnancy, poor women may be, or lower-income women may be, more vulnerable. You know, poor women who when there wasn't a recession going on, who may have felt able to take care of a child or another child may have, you know, in the midst of a recession when they don't have a job or health insurance or their partner doesn't have a job or just lost their health insurance, may have decided to instead have an abortion instead of having a child. And then another factor that we think may have contributed is that there are a number of pro-choice organizations that collect donations that they use, that they distribute to poor women to help subsidize the cost of their abortions. And our expectation is that donations to these types of funds, abortion funds or groups, have increased in recent years, and that too has increased access to abortion services for low-income women.
Since the economic pressures are much higher on low-income women to have abortions during a recession, has that affected the overall abortion rate? Has it gone up?
Right, and that is a question that we don't have an answer to. The most recent year for which we have abortion data are 2005. We do know between 2000 and 2005, numbers of abortions and abortion rates steadily declined. We don't know what's happened between 2005 and 2008. Recent data that were released by the CDC last November for 2006 suggest that there may have been a small increase in both numbers of abortions and abortion rates. But again, the CDC data are incomplete, and so that's kind of a tentative finding, if you will. And so, again, we're actually in the process right now of collecting information on numbers of abortions in 2008 and hope to be releasing that information early next year. But we don't even have tentative findings on that right now.
So these abortion funds, these are things like the National Network of Abortion Funds and other organizations that explicitly set out to fill the gaps that the Hyde Amendment has created. So are you suggesting that they've really grown substantially in the past few years? Is that something that's really happened? Or I guess I was under the impression they've always been around.
I guess they've always been around. I think they have grown in number. If you look at the reports released by the National Network of Abortion Fund, you do see kind of this gradual increase in contributions and in number of women that are helped. And again, there's a number of independent funds that are also putting more and more effort into, and especially during the recession, they actually got a fair amount of media coverage because they were getting more and more demands. And so I think a lot of these groups, a lot of these funds were putting more effort into raising more money.
What role does contraception play in this? Are low-income women losing access to contraception services? Could that be a factor?
That could definitely be a factor. Again, some research that Guttmacher did, I think we released about a year ago, ACOG had some similar research, and actually wasn't even focused just on low-income women, but was just a survey of women trying to find out how or if the recession was impacting their fertility intentions and contraceptive use. And what both of these surveys found is that, you know, relative to, you know, 2 years ago, because again, the survey was about a year ago, that women, you know, wanted to delay childbearing or have fewer children, but by the same token, because, you know, money was tighter and fewer of them had health insurance, they were also cutting corners sometimes on contraceptive use. They were having a hard time getting access to hormonal methods, getting their refills and things like that. So even though, you know, there was this increased desire to delay childbearing, women had fewer means to do it and were cutting corners in ways that were not going to help them not get pregnant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, hormonal contraception
can seem cheap on the surface, but it's not if you're from a low-income household. You guys also looked into the role that insurance plays in abortion and abortion decisions. And what I thought was really interesting was that you found that not many women pay for abortion with private insurance, even if that's something that's available to them. Can you talk some about how many women pay for abortion in cash versus through insurance?
Right. So this was the first time that we've asked on this survey. We've asked women both about what type of health insurance coverage they have and how they're paying for the abortion. And so it was news to us that, you know, wasn't surprising necessarily, but it was the first time we had a number to show that, you know, 33% of women, a third of women having abortions don't have health insurance, about a third have Medicaid for general health care, and about a third have private health insurance. And then our follow-up question was, how are you paying for this abortion? And what we found is that most women, 57%, were paying for their abortions out of pocket. And then the second most common payment method was Medicaid. Followed by kind of reduced fee or these subsidized abortion funds. And then we found that 12% of women were using private health insurance to pay for the abortion. Now remember, about one-third of women have private health insurance, but only 12% of women were using it to pay for the abortion. So in turn, only about a third of women who have private health insurance were using it to pay for the abortions. Now, again, we didn't ask questions on the survey to help us better understand the reasons for those patterns, but again, we know just from talking to women who get abortions, from talking to providers, that there's a couple of factors that contribute to that. One is a number of women have private health insurance that excludes abortion coverage or doesn't cover abortion services. Some women are unaware that their private health insurance covers this. Some women don't want it on their insurance records because they're worried that a family member or another health care provider or an employer might see it. And then finally, you know, we suspect that a number of women have pretty crappy health insurance and they have these really high deductibles of a couple hundred or even a couple $1,000 that they have to pay before the health insurance kicks in. So, you know, most of the first trimester abortion costs on average $413. So maybe a number of them had, even though they had private health insurance, that they hadn't met these deductibles, they were still going to have to pay out of pocket for the abortion. And so we think it's a combination of those four factors that explains why most women who have private health insurance aren't able or don't use it to pay for their abortions.
Do you think that this recently passed health care reform legislation is going to have any kind of effect on some of these statistics?
That is a hard one for me because my DC colleagues are intimately familiar with the ins and outs of healthcare reform and all the changes that are going to be implemented in the coming years. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to plead ignorance on that one. I know there is a lot of concern that, especially there's a number of states that are implementing or trying to implement laws saying that private health insurance, regardless of source, can't cover abortion services. So even though a seemingly small proportion of abortions, 12% were paid for by private health insurance in 2008, that's still a lot of women who are going to have to scramble if they're not able to use their private health insurance, that are going to have to scramble to come up with the money to pay for that.
Other than the poverty line issue, which was, of course, the news leader on this, you found that the demographics of women having an abortion remain pretty stable. Can you talk a little bit about what stayed the same?
Right. Well, pretty much, it's almost as if everything besides poverty stayed the same. So the age distribution of abortion patients is the same. It's still the case that the majority of women having abortions are in their 20s. Women in their 30s are the second largest age group among abortion patients. The majority of women having abortions have one or more children. 61% of women having abortions have one or more children. Distribution of religious affiliation stayed the same. Race and ethnicity pretty much stayed the same. And the characteristics that did seem to increase, if you look closely, really didn't increase. So, for example, There was an increase in the proportion of abortion patients who had a college degree. In 2000, 16% of abortion patients had college degrees. This increased to 20% in 2008. But this was really a factor of, if you look at, again, the larger population of women, there was a shift towards higher education among all women in the U.S. So, again, this is, to our mind, this explains why we saw an increase in the proportion of abortion patients who had college degrees.
I'm interested in the fact that the second largest group is women in their 30s. I knew that women in their 20s was like the first largest group, but that really runs up against the stereotype that abortion patients are usually like teenage girls.
Start over. So yeah, that's our perception too, is that a lot of people think that most women who have abortions are teenagers, or at best are, you know, college students, young college students and teens. But again, the fact of the matter is most of them, 58% of women having abortions are in their 20s. I think about 22% of abortion patients are in their 30s. I think the reason, where that perception comes from is because of a lot of legislation focuses on adolescents. And so that just makes it, in turn, I guess people think that it's only adolescents or mostly adolescents who have abortions. But the fact of the matter is it's mostly women in their 20s and 30s. And again, women who have children, women who are economically vulnerable and are having troubles taking care of the children that they do have, as opposed to, again, this kind of stereotype of the irresponsible teenager.
What were the racial breakdowns that you see amongst women that have abortions, and has that changed at all in the past 8 years?
Right. So I know it's a dull to walk through numbers in an interview like this, but I'll just say most commonly, women obtaining abortions, 36% were non-Hispanic white, 30% were non-Hispanic black, 9% were non-Hispanic other race, and 25%, one in four women having abortions, were Hispanic. The distributions, because, you know, I'm a statistician of sorts, the changes that we saw between 2000 and 2008, none of the changes were statistically significant. By the same token, we did see an increase in the proportion of abortion patients who were Hispanic. 20% were Latina or Hispanic in 2000 compared to 25% in 2008. This wasn't a statistically significant increase in our analysis. It doesn't mean it wasn't a real one. But again, this is part of, if you look at shifts in the population of all women, there's more Hispanic women in the U.S. now. So again, all other things being equal, you would expect to see an increase in this over time.
So the fact that the number of women under the poverty line, or the percentage of women having abortions that were under the poverty line, didn't change the racial dynamics at all.
Right. Interestingly, it did not. That, again, poverty was the only thing that shifted. All the other demographic characteristics seemed to stay the same during that time period.
Interesting. My guest today has been Rachel Jones. She's a senior research assistant for the Guttmacher Institute. She co-authored a recent paper titled Characteristics of U.S. Abortion Patients, the Year 2008. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last Sunday, May 9th, was the 50th anniversary of the FDA approving the use of the birth control pill as contraception. And of course, this means that this was an easy-peasy, time-filling story over that weekend for news anchors and pundits. Contraception is largely uncontroversial in the mainstream of American society. So a lot of the coverage was blessedly free of the hand-wringing that you get when it comes to abortion, even though the anti-choice movement, by and large, disapproves of the pill right alongside abortion. But that doesn't mean all media outlets ignored any controversy over the pill. NPR, for instance, reminded the audience that it wasn't until after the pill got approved by the FDA that legal obstacles to obtaining contraception started to be rolled back by the courts.
In 1873, Congress passed a law that banned birth control information as obscene. In Connecticut, the use of birth control was a crime until 1965, when the Supreme Court overturned the bans on contraceptive use by married couples, citing the right to privacy. 50 years ago today, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it had approved the birth control pill for sale.
Still, part of me was really glad to see breezy, cheerful, non-controversial reporting on this anniversary. Like this quickie from CNN.
Okay, like I said, it is Mother's Day. And get this, it's also the 50th anniversary of the FDA approving the birth control pill. Doctors say it's one of the most important inventions of the last century since it helps women control their own fertility. Most women, American women that is, say that the pill improved their lives and it is still their favorite kind of contraception.
This is really how it should be. Contraception treated like a normal, everyday part of women's lives. But it really does have a fascinating history. And I was happy to see some networks like NBC dive in a little deeper, talking to historians and reproductive rights activists about the long road from when the pill was first approved, or even conceived, and what it's like for women nowadays. Nancy Gibbs spoke about how the pill really wasn't something many single women had access to in the 1960s, even though many of them were sexually active.
It's probably natural to blame the sexual revolution on the pill because they arrived together, but right. It doesn't mean one caused the other. Throughout the 1960s, in many states, contraception was still illegal. Mm-hmm. And even Planned Parenthood clinics would not prescribe the birth control pill to single women. If you went to your doctor, you needed to be married to get it. Now, there were workarounds. You know, girls right. were known to borrow an engagement ring from a friend, and doctors were not detectives. But by and large, it was not accepted for single women until really into the 1970s. And that's when you start to see the more dramatic social changes that resulted from.
What she doesn't address is the big reason why things changed so quickly in the 70s. It wasn't just Roe versus Wade, though I'm sure that was part of it. It was also a 1972 decision called Eisenstadt versus Baird, where the Supreme Court decided that if married couples had a right to access contraception, then single people should as well. In a lot of ways, it was a decision with as much impact as Roe or Griswold versus Connecticut, which legalized contraception for married couples. It made it acceptable and legal for single women to use contraception to control not just giving birth, but also who they married and when. And now the pill is widespread.
Today, an estimated 12 million American women use the pill, and about 80% will use it at some point in their reproductive lives.
But of course, when it comes to women having sex without getting punished, there's going to be a bunch of naysayers. Headline News took comments from people on Facebook, and naysaying and prudery was all over the place. Some people had relevant points about the problem of STDs, but you always get at least some people who think sexual pleasure is a bad thing.
Let's check some Facebook comments. Lori writes, the pills change the way we look at sex and how we go about being sexual. But for a long time, they gave everyone a false sense of security, too, as STDs increased with a higher number of partners. Tiffany says, it doesn't protect against STDs, and I think that should be advertised in huge letters. So many people on the pill don't think to use condoms because they're on birth control. Laura writes, absolutely, the pill revolutionized sex. It gave women the freedom to enjoy sex without worrying about getting pregnant. It put women in charge of their fertility, and yes, it's still relevant today. Terry says, it led to extramarital experimentation and therefore helped to undermine the institution of marriage. We still hold our spouses accountable for fidelity under those old ideals.
I love the idea that the only reason someone might want to be faithful is so that they don't have extramarital pregnancies. I never stop being impressed by the way that conservatives never stop to consider that people might treat their partners with respect because they love them, not because they're living in fear of getting caught. Anyway, I thought I'd let Loretta Lynn wave us out of this segment with a clip from her famous song, The Pill.
You wine me and dine me when I was your girl. Promised if I'd be your wife, you'd show me the world. But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Get rid of that wedding ring edition. Representative Steve King suggested that discrimination against gay people is the fault of gay people not being in the closet.
If you don't project it, if you don't advertise it, how would anyone know to discriminate against you? And that's at the basis of this. So if people wear their sexuality on their sleeve and then they want to bring litigation against someone that they would point their finger at and say, you discriminate, It is an entrapment that is legalized by the END Act.
You hear this a lot, that gay people flaunt their sexuality by not hiding it. To everyone who says this, I ask them if they're planning on not marrying or boycotting all weddings. Roughly 100% of people who say this have no problem with straight people flaunting their sexuality with wedding rings, weddings, putting up family pictures in the office, mentioning a spouse, etc. The excuse that sexuality flaunting is somehow intrinsically wrong is farcical on its face.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debates. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.